Hello, listener. Welcome to Switch It, the podcast where it all began. England were dealt one last kick in the Baz balls as India closed out a 4-1 series win in Dharamshala, a tour that began with the high of Hyderabad, ended up going the way of so many before it, as Ben Stokes' side went down by an innings inside 3 days. Even the extra time on the golf course might not have been enough to lift the mood. India flexed their muscle, as expected, and did so despite a number of high-profile absentees. But will such a crushing defeat for England finally put the B-word to bed? It is so Moorish, after all. Hopefully today's panel will have strong views either way, as I'm joined by ESPN Cricket Info UK editor Andrew Miller, and thanks to the wonders of the interweb, associate editor Vidushan Ahantaraja and assistant editor Kartik Krishnaswamy. Miller, nice to see you. Like me, you've braved the sort of weather that makes cricket in the English spring so appealing.
Yeah, it's been soggy out there. Delightfully soggy, but you know, it's another season is looming, and another series has been put to bed. So see what this one's got to offer.
Well, we'll get into the winter of discontent soon enough. Vish and Kartik, I think you've both had enough of Dharamshala's charms. Tell us where you are now.
So I'm currently in Delhi, having left this morning, and it was really sunny. Actually, it was quite nice. There was even a little bit of rain last night as well, which I don't know why, just really kind of summed up where England were at, I suppose. But no, I'm currently in Delhi, and I'll be flying back on Wednesday morning. Yeah,
I'm still in Dharamshala, and I decided to stay a couple of days extra, thinking why not, and then little realizing that the match would end so soon. and it's raining here as well. So like I was up in MacLeodganj like an hour ago or so, and then I decided to walk down, and it began to rain, and somehow I made it in time.
Lovely. So twice as much Dharamshala, and twice as much getting wet. From the sounds of it. Well, it's keeping with the theme. It's absolutely bucketing it down here in London and the general southeast, I think. Standard English weather at the start of March. Right then, the business. Miller, I'll come to you. Is it time to pen the affectionate remembrance, burn a set of Baz bales, and give the bashes to India?
Well, they've certainly claimed the bashes, haven't they? I mean, it's England got a proper schooling at the end of it. You know, by the end of what we witnessed, England were no longer playing in the carefree, no consequences manner of cricket that they had set out to play, and that was partly their fault and partly due to the skill of their opponents, who just outmuscled them over the course of the series. We'll come into the various mistakes that England made along the way, and they did make plenty, but I don't think it necessarily means the end of the way that England go about it. I don't think England have got an option. I think this is always the case with the Baz ball mentality. It was a solution to a very English problem that they don't have the players with the technical proficiency to play Test cricket in the traditional manner. And they have got a very white ball mindset, thanks to the efforts that went into building that white ball team that won the World Cup in 2019. And all of the kids coming through have taken those guys as their icons and recognise that, you know, that's the zeitgeist. That's where the money is ultimately with the way that the T20 franchise system is exploding as well. There's no putting the genie back in the bottle. You're not going to suddenly turn around and say, you know, let's get back to the days of Alistair Cook propping on the front dog and blocking your way to glory in India. You're not going to do that. And so, no, I don't think it's the end of England going down this route, but I do think it needs some finessing, which Brendan McCullum himself acknowledged that England got found out with their over gung-ho approach. I mean, you know, it was gung-ho in mentality, if not in execution. They need to be more subtle about the way they go about it. But I don't think that necessarily means stopping what they're doing. I think fundamentally, and I've agreed with this all along, fundamentally, this is the right way for this set of players, this generation coming through and previously existing, to produce their best cricket. And so I would expect certainly, you know, if the next big ticket event is the tour of Australia in a couple of years' time, I would be astonished if England don't think that the way they've gone about their cricket in the last 2 years isn't the right way to go out to Australia and give it a good go in the way that they clearly haven't in the last three tours.
And, I mean, you will have paid particular note to this, but Ben Stokes, they do seem to have realised that they need to define Baz ball for themselves now after you gave the world.
Look, it's I made the point in the last pod that it's really self-defeating. If there is a term out there that everybody is using, Bazball is what England are doing, and then England come out and say, oh, we don't do Bazball, which begs the question, what on earth are you doing? If you're not going to define, if you're not going to use the empty vessel of Bazball, which essentially it is, because nobody else has adequately filled the void that is what is Bazball. If England don't do it for themselves, you just get everyone else doing it for it. History is written by people who write history. If you don't bother to write down your own history, someone's going to write the history for you, aren't they? And so record it on a podcast. So yeah, absolutely. You know, they may not like the nuts and bolts of the word itself, but it's self-defeating to avoid using it and say, oh, we ascribe to higher values. And that just sounds pretentious, frankly. And that's part of the reason why I think people have been so keen to beat them down with it.
Pretentious, moi. Vish, Ben Stokes said in the build-up to this final test that 3-2 looks a lot better than 4-1. In the cold light of day, then, how bad does 4-1 look? And other than the fact it fits, I think, with your original prediction back in January.
Yeah, it does. It does. I think this 4-1, I don't know that if it's worse than, you know, I suppose the way a previous England team might have lost 4-1 in India. But they were, you know, they were clumsy in parts. And all the way through it felt like quite a mistake-addled 4-1. And that's not to say that England had chances throughout those final four tests to really see something, but they ended up just making it a little bit easy for India at various points. All the while, India were just growing into the beast that eventually saw them smashing them in that final test. So I suppose, like, in the moment, it felt like, oh, you know, England were, there's a lot of back and forth, and England were just missing out on those pressure moments. But, you know, they build up over a five test series, don't they? And you know, you mentioned at the start of India superstars and stuff like that. And I think what's going to happen actually is the result, the nature of this result, the nature of this 4-1 scoreline is going to get worse as time goes on. Because, you know, while there are easily digestible bits of where England messed up. So, you know, the 8 wicket collapse in the third test being 170 ahead with India 7 wickets down in their first innings, and then, you know, essentially just flunking that as well. And then the nature of this defeat, and also the fact that actually this defeat being the fifth test, but also the fact that actually the one test they won by 28 runs or something like that, India were without one of the best chasers in world cricket in Virat Kohli. So, you know, as time goes on, I think it's not going to be as flattering a 4-1 as it looked, you know, in that, you know, well, right now. I think it is going to get progressively worse, I suppose.
And England did, of course, win that first game, despite conceding a 190-run deficit, which never usually looks very good for a team. KK, give us the overarching view on Bazball, then, from an Indian perspective. For a start, I presume you'll be grateful not to hear the term in every press conference for a while.
Yeah, it would. But I think the kind of extreme reactions to Bazball do it a disservice, because like Miller said, it's a philosophy that suits the group of players they've got. And they've not just like decided, okay, we're just going to go out there and like, you know, slog everything. That's not what they do. They know like that Ben Duckett is like particularly good at certain shots, or like Zach Crawley is particularly good at, you know, playing certain attacking shots, but not at certain other ones. So they, you know, they understand their own game and like understand their own strengths and really work hard on them. And then they're like, okay, you know what, if Zach Crawley is driving on the up and he gets out, okay, that's fine because he's good at that. If Duckett, you know, tries to cut something that's like really close to off stump and gets out, that's all right because he's really good at that. So it's they know what they're doing, and they've like worked really hard at it, and it's not, you know, they've not just decided, you know, go out there and just do whatever you feel like. No, it's there's a lot of thought that's gone into it. The thing is that, you know, whether you come to India and play this current Indian team, this current Indian bowling attack, whether you, you know, attack them, whether you like defend them. Like last year, Australia, they came here. There were innings where they tried to sweep everything. They tried to go hard, didn't work. There were innings where they, you know, tried to really buckle down and defend, and that didn't work either. So there's no easy answers to like how you play against India in India. And England tried something, and I don't think they tried something that was, you know, without merit. But it didn't work, and it's that happens. So that's my view of baseball, basically.
That's all very fair-minded and reasonable, and entirely what we didn't want on it. So there we go. Mitigation for for the baseballers. This final test, though, Miller, was a bit of an old-fashioned schooling. Defeat inside 8 sessions, despite all the positivity going into it. Some of England's batting was dodgier than Kate Middleton's Photoshop efforts. From winning the toss and being 100 for 1, it was pretty much a nosedive from on high from that point on.
Yeah, it was a pretty dismal performance, but it was set up by the circumstances that England had ended up with as a consequence of everything else that had gone on in the series. And now, you know, in terms of where England tried to get to in this series, you know, I said it before, I'll say it again, their aim in this tour, and probably when they go to Australia again in 2 years' time, was to win 3-2. Because Ben Stokes has actively said he's not interested in the draw. He's basically ruled out the draw. He's willing to gamble, essentially. He's willing to coin flip at the key moments and say, you know what, I think we're better off taking the coin flip and thinking, you know, if this moment comes off, then we will win this test. If this moment comes off, we will lose the test. But by the time that England got to that final test, I think India were just too strong. India were aware of England's plans. If you think back to the tentative, not so much the fact that the first test was a miraculous win for England, but if you think back to the way in which India were batting, in particular batting, that's obviously the bowling was what won it ultimately, but the batting that India produced in that test was tentative in the way that they were playing, very straight line, very cautious, full of doubt, not so much doubt in their own ability, but doubt in the consequences of playing big shots and getting them wrong, which essentially was the one genius part of the way England have set up with throughout this baseball era. If you have no consequences, you have the freedom to play the way you want to. And increasingly, you saw the way in which India grew into that space that England occupied, so much so that by the end of the series, they've scored 77 sixes to 30 or whatever it is. And you recall, you know, Shubman Gill's innings, the century he scored in the second test, wasn't it? Epitomises for me that flip in mindset, the fact that he was so tentative, so nervous, could have got out 3 times before he barely got off the mark, but got through that and increasingly grew into the game, so much so that, you know, by the end of the series he was looking masterful. And Jaiswal likewise had been this one outlier for India all the way through, and by the end of the series he was so far ahead of England in confidence stakes that England were just a wreck in his rearview mirror. And so that created the space in which the India's bowlers could come back into it by the end of that series, by the end of the game, you know, with Ashwin just dominating the way that he had done 4 years ago and pretty much every time he's come up against England in his own conditions. All of that positive mental attitude that England had come into the series with had been blown out of the water partly by the fact that they had lost their coin flips. They lost their moments where they thought, you know what, and you know, it's hard not to double down on Joe Root's reverse scoop here, because it is probably the biggest coin flip that we had all series long. If that shot comes off, if he gets a bit more bat on it, goes for 6 over the cordon's head, and suddenly England are in that positive mindset space where they can build on their 200-for-2 overnight position. I mean, it's a different world. The fact that England are willing to boil their game down essentially to a toss of the coin, not the top of the innings with the actual toss, but the willingness to boil the game down. I don't care whether we win or lose, but we're going to give it a go either way. And they lost. And by the end of the series, they knew they'd lost. And that, I think, is why they got absolutely pounded by the end of it.
I guess that's about giving themselves a puncher's chance, and sometimes you end up getting punched there. Carter, you wrote, I think, after a couple of tests about how England's spinners were outperforming India's spinners, but the real challenge is to keep doing that over the course of the series. Obviously, we saw that played out and it finished with sort of Kuldeep and Ashwin spinning rings around England. And also the batting order, an Indian batting order that was missing key players, had several debutants in there, also began to function at the level you'd expect. So by that, by Dharamshala, you had all of the top five passing 50. You had hundreds for Rohit and Gill. And I mean, this was kind of the challenge sort of expected England to have to deal with on this tour.
Yeah, I mean, I take one exception to like this relentless positivism that Stokes and whoever like talks about, whoever the team sends out to talk about their approach. You know, they project this so much. But look, when you have such an inexperienced Indian batting lineup, England's chance was to like try and put more pressure on them. And I don't think they did enough of that. I don't think they kept playing just four bowlers and they kept over bowling their spinners. The best position they got into in the series, like forget Hyderabad where it was, you know, like a little bit of a freak win. They played really well, but it was a bit of a freak win. But in Ranchi, how day two ended, that was the position for them to really like pounce, right? They'd won a toss on a pitch where the toss was really important. And they really had India like down. And at that point, I think they just ran out of bowling. Like Shoaib Bashir just kept bowling and tiring. And Kuldeep Yadav looked so comfortable there. I just think right through the series, they needed that extra bowler and they never tried it even once. And when I asked Ben Stokes that at the final press conference in Dharamshala, he was like, no, I'm not going to talk about it. I don't deal in hindsight. I mean, the rest of the press conference was pretty much dealing in hindsight, but that's what he said. So yeah, I just think they didn't. The most attacking thing you can do is like try whatever you can to take 20 wickets, and I think they were a little timid there. And you may ask, like, okay, you know, India have Jadeja, India have Ashwin, they can bat, and you know that makes it easier for them to play five bowlers. But I mean, first two tests when I watched Tom Hartley and Rehan Ahmed bat, they can bat. So why not play the two of them, play a third spinner and two quicks, like. Or three seamers and two spinners. Just try it.
Yeah, I mean, Vish, that's something that we've discussed England's approach. There never seemed to be much thought given to playing a side of that sort of balance. I suppose that potentially mean dropping Bairstow and batting Folks at six. And as people, you know, you look at Baseball and the way England have played, and it on the surface is all about the batting strength, you know, scoring 500 in a day or whatever. And clearly England would have expected the batters to get more out of this tour, given the pitches were pretty good. You know, Joe Root's record in India and so on. Each batter kind of had his moment, but no one really put together a consistent series, apart from Zach Crawley, who didn't score 100. And bowling wise, the magic trick of Stokes has been to, you know, getting wickets, taking, you know, bowling teams out. There have been very few times when they haven't taken all 10 innings until this tour. Is it just hindsight to say, oh, actually, they should have played an extra bowler? Or do you think internally they will have discussed that as, you know, any sort of sensible team management would have done?
Yeah, I mean, I think internally they did discuss it. And I think also, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, it did feel like the team was a bit unbalanced at Vizag. That was when they went in with the three full-time spinners and Jimmy as the sole seamer. You know, the link between the batting and the bowling, I suppose, you know, like if we talk about how Ben Stokes has operated from the very start, you know, they have consistently got 10 wickets. He does bowl, you know, he is keen on bowling his bowlers not into the ground, because that sounds, you know, for want of a better phrase, certainly bowling them constantly. There was a remember there was a game, I think it was at Headingley in that 2022 summer where Matthew Potts bowled like 10 or 15 on the bounce, something ridiculous like that. There was the game where he picked himself as the all-round option and then didn't bowl himself because he wanted to test the attack, basically, which seems crazy now, but he did that and he admitted to it. And I suppose the complication was not just that he wasn't an all-rounder, not just that Joe Root wasn't the, you know, all-rounder that, you know, certainly very optimistically we thought he could be coming into this series, but also the fact that Johnny Bairstow and Ben Folkes didn't fire, the fact that they can both keep. Now, obviously, Folkes is a superior keeper, but you're in a weird situation there where you've got two people who can keep who aren't batting particularly well. And worse still, they're batting poorly in two very different ways. You know, one bloke's constantly trying to be on the attack and the other bloke can't attack, but they both keep. So you're in, I suppose we didn't really talk about that through the series, but I suppose, you know, if you were going to realise KK's, team there in terms of what he suggested England should do, I suppose it's one of them, isn't it? It's one of those that come out and it's likely to be Folkes, isn't it? Which is, I suppose, a decision that they took in the summer during the Ashes, but wasn't a decision they were willing to take in India. So, yeah, you know, Johnny Bairstow wouldn't have played his 100th test, which is fine, really. That's, you know, these are the kind of things you need to do to win test matches, let alone test series. But, yeah, I think they arrived with an idea of how things would work. And I think a lot of that, you know, the optimistic parts worked really well in Tom Hartley and Shoaib Bashir, in that they performed far better than anyone thought they'd perform. But then the other bits that they assumed they'd work out themselves, like Joe Root's form, Ben Stokes' form, Johnny Bairstow's form, just didn't really. And even little things like Mark Woods, you know, took 4-for-1 innings, but largely didn't get the movement they hoped he was going to get. Ollie Robinson feels like a different story altogether. So there's, you know, obviously we started with this talking about the bowling, but it's hard to shift the bowling if you don't, you know, make allowances with the batting. And it was the middle order that perhaps could have lost something, but it didn't feel like they were ever entertaining that in particular as an option throughout this series.
And in terms of balancing the side, Miller, England had, they were given a box office example, it crystallised the issue with around Stokes' knee when he came on for his first bowl of the series in Dharamshala and promptly pegged back Rohit Sharma's off stump, having already scored 100.
Yeah, I mean, we've been Vish was shooting the breeze about this earlier, about what is the impact of Stokes being an all-rounder compared to Stokes losing one of his strings. How important is it to an all-rounder to believe that he's got both strings? Because, you know, he looked so off the pace with the bat. You know, in terms of captaincy, fine. I thought Stokes captained incredibly well, incredibly well on the first few tests when he's marshalling the spinners. He conjured that first test victory just by A, through the power of positive thinking, and B, just backing his man, Hartley in particular, on that occasion. So, you know, he did the right things. He did much of the alchemy that he's produced as captain all along. But his batting just went backwards. And, you know, I said it last pod that, you know, he in the end, he came to epitomise precisely the sort of die-in-a-ditch mentality that England were insistent they weren't going to go about. You know, there he was. I suppose his apogee being Headingley 2019, and we all know the legend of how he batted, you know, the first two runs from about 60 balls, whatever it was, and just hung in there, waiting for the moment. And he batted as though he was waiting for the moment all along. But ultimately, you know, you can't just wait for the moment. You've got to be the moment sometimes. You know, you know, if you're the cavalry, you've got to turn up. You know, Battle of Waterloo required the Prussians to actually appear, didn't it? You know, it's kind of useful sometimes to actually appear over the horizon with trumpets blaring and think, yahoo, here I come. And he didn't. He just died in a ditch and then kept looking confuddled when he got bowled by, you know, got bowled by some decent deliveries and a couple of from Jasprit Bumrah were outstanding. But broadly speaking, you know, he was striding forward in these determined defensive positions. But actually, you know, if you look side on, he wasn't actually getting out of the crease very much at all. He was giving the big show of being Ben Stokes, the defensive hero who's going to come to the party at some stage, but never did. So, you know, he epitomised everything that did go wrong with England's approach. But the one thing I've touched on Jasprit Bumrah there. The one thing that needs to be acknowledged, I think, I don't think we have yet, is the extent to which Bumrah initially and Kuldeep ultimately just came out at England with a pair of performances that just were absolutely exactly what you need to quash Bazball. That performance from Bumrah in the second test, when, you know, six for him in the first innings in particular, absolutely extraordinarily brilliant bowling. You know, when England have set themselves up, basically their entire mindset, their entire approach on this tour was, we're going to score our runs before we get a ball with our name on it. And then you get Bumrah in that test, and Kuldeep later on in the series, just producing balls with a name on it endlessly. You know, there was so, you know, just Johnny Bairstow had literally no answer to Kuldeep every single time he tossed the ball up. It, you know, there were those two in particular just came and met England in their territory to a degree that even Ashwin and Jadeja in particular, you know, the two guys who are synonymous with thrashing England in their own conditions. If you look back to the way in which England dominated those two in particular in the first two tests, you know, going at 4 and 5 and over, sweeping it with impunity, particularly even Ollie Pope in that first test. And then you look at the way in which those two came out and just met England on their own terms and said, you know what, if you want to score your runs, you've got to get past these deliveries first. And broadly speaking, they didn't. So, you know, ultimately, Stokes epitomised everything that went wrong for England's Bazball batting. But he wasn't alone. That middle order, Root included, and Bairstow with his incomplete series of everything above 25, but nothing above 39. The fact that three Test Centurion batsmen, caps-wise, produced pretty anonymous series when it mattered. And yet, you know, we're still talking about England being broadly competitive until they weren't. It goes to show something about the positive mentality and the positive attitude that, in spite of the fact that so many of their key players went missing, they still just about competed until such time as they were clearly beaten and then got thrashed.
There was one memorable moment from an England perspective, certainly. James Anderson became the third man ever to take 700 test wickets, celebrated in a fittingly iconic setting, even if the dismissal of Kuldeep Yadav for 30 would usually go unremarked. Vish, as you predicted beforehand, he did look reasonably pleased about the achievement.
Yeah, he did. He did, although he wouldn't want to talk about it. He didn't want to talk about it after he decided not to do press, which is fine. I think he's doing tail-enders today anyway. He was pleased about it. I think he was also a little embarrassed as well. I think considering how long it's taken to get to that mark, 15 wickets in 8 tests and something like that, his last 8 tests. This has been the longest stretch, this 600 to 700 out of all those, you know, century bits in his career so far. The previous longest was the 0 to 100, where he had all these issues that I suppose that were put on him, really. You know, the change in the action, coming back going back to his old action, then coming back. And this feels like a different kind of, well, I mean, obviously, it's a totally different kind of situation for him to be in, but because he had to go away after the summer, work out what was wrong, figure out what was wrong, and then correct it. You know, he bowled well during this series, but, you know, I suppose India sat on him pretty comfortably, really. You know, there were a couple of spectacular deliveries in there. There were the first two in Vizag, I think, on that first morning, which were pretty sound. But I think by and large, yeah, it was a milestone that, you know, he always talks about, you know, he's not that bothered by milestones, this, that and the other. But I think he was going to be quite bothered by this one because it is history to be the first seamer past that 700 mark. And in the end, it just took a little bit too long. And I think maybe, I wondered actually if he'd rather take it in England than overseas, but, you know, his parents were there. And you know, obviously he said it's an iconic setting. I think he's just happy to get out of the way now, because I suppose the next thing is passing Shane Warne's tally. But I think by and large, it's taken a lot longer than he would have liked.
Well, we'll wait and see how long it takes him to get to 800. Kartik, just the again, the sort of outsider perspective on this, is this is a sort of a feat of endurance as much as skill. But are England right to sort of, you know, or English supporters kind of hold Anderson up as this point of greatness, or should the English team actually be thinking about moving on? I think we've touched a little bit on the balance of the side and how and it's been written about how many overs he bowls and so on. He's clearly very good at what he does, but is he what an English Test 11 needs on a tour of India, say?
Short answer, no. But like, let's break this down, because skill wise, he's still really, really up there. Like when he bowls, like, you know, every time he bowled a spell in this series, he just looked sharp. He was bowling pretty good speeds. He was doing something even when there was not much help. He was, you know, like his lengths were just immaculate. And when there was a bit of help, he looked genuinely dangerous. But like, you know, it's happened over a period of time where like he'd end a lot of tours with really good averages. But then like you look at how many wickets he's taking per test match. It's, you know, I don't know how many wickets did he take in this series? 9, 10, something 10, like that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 10,
10, 10, and he played 4 of the 5 tests, right? And yep. Like, yeah, and day 2 in Dharamshala was classic example. I thought he bowled a short morning spell when India were kind of just, you know, like Rohit and Gill were just getting into their innings again and like stuff. And then he went off, and then right after lunch, like he didn't bowl again in the first session. Then right after lunch, he came back. Bowled, I think, 4 or maybe 5 overs. That must have been his longest spell of the day. And there, you know, the ball change happened and the ball did something. And you could see, like, again, like in that window, brief window that he operated in, he looked really good and he looked threatening. But then he went off. So, right. So as soon as him and Stokes were done with that spell, life just got so much easier for Sarfraz and Padikkal. And again, like, late in the day when India were, I don't know, Kuldeep and Jasprit Bumrah were batting, the spinners just kept bowling and bowling and bowling, and Anderson never came back. So, you know, if you're only playing 4 bowlers, if you're playing 5 bowlers, yeah, I can see a place for Anderson in that attack. If you're only playing 4 bowlers, I really don't know if, A, is he not willing to like take on a bigger workload, or are England managing his workload such that he only bowls a certain number of overs in a match or in a day's play, or whatever it is, it's not working. I don't think it's working for them. In England, I'm sure he's still going to be, you know, really effective, playing as one of 3 main seamers, plus hopefully Stokes if he's fit, plus 1 spinner probably. But, you know, on tour, if you're playing 4 bowlers, I don't think Anderson can be one of them.
Well, we'll see how many more tours Anderson goes on. I'm reminded of a line by our former colleague, George DeBell, about making a Ferrari carry scaffolding back when England did used to overbowl Anderson, perhaps. Milo,
what is the alternative for England? I mean, we kind of saw what the alternative was on this tour with when Mark Wood played and played very well for one test, was absolutely ineffectual on the other occasions because his pace didn't work. Ollie Robinson was a waste of rations. I mean, you know, Anderson is the proven guy who can fulfill that role. And obviously, without Ben Stokes being able to bowl until that final test, you know, he's kind of over a barrel a little bit in that England needed to play 2 spinners. And how do you fit them in the balance without Stokes being the all-rounder? So, it's a really tough one. I do agree with the concerns about Anderson's role. I think I was surprised that he was as effective as he was, given how he performed in the Ashes, to be perfectly honest. But there is clearly a danger that he turns into a sort of a bit of a holy cow within this team. You know, I sometimes make the comparison with the last days of Kapil Dev and just watching him trudge over the line to get to break Hadley's record and be done with it. I don't think it's quite reached that point with Anderson. As KK said, I think he has still got all the techers required to be successful. But England have got, I suppose England have put back themselves into a position where they are looking for their seamers to be impact bowlers because they're so obsessed with getting wickets. They want to make sure that every time he comes on, it's to be an impactful spell with backed up with fields that can take wickets and all the rest of it. And that possibly didn't happen often enough, as he got a very good five wicket haul in that second test when Bumrah bowled like a god. But broadly speaking, I think it was just a symptom of the fact that England were just outgunned ultimately by an India batting lineup that saw their bluff, essentially, recognised Bazball for what it ultimately is a confidence trick. I've said that from the outset. And on this occasion, they saw through the confidence trick and England were therefore no longer confident. And so if you're not confident and still trying to bang down the door in the manner that England have done reasonably successfully up till now, it looks even worse when it doesn't come off than it would have done if England had gone in with their traditional approach of, you know, three seamers and one spinner and everyone busts a gut but looks ineffective in the traditional sense. The fact that Anderson didn't bowl as much as perhaps he should have done was probably more, in my opinion, a reflection of Stokes's faith in his young bowlers, his young spinners, saying, you know what, I back you, because that's basically what got England that victory in that first test, was the fact that he unequivocally backed his men. And so if he's still unequivocally backing his men even in adversity, you've got to bowl them, haven't you? So I suppose that's where the dichotomy where Anderson's concern sneaks in. I mean, when do you use him in adversity in this day and age?
The inevitable question, and Vish, I'm going to make you hostage to fortune here. Anderson going to be 42 this summer. Are we entering the end game?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I think maybe it comes to an end this summer. It feels like, you know, not to say a reason for moving him on is because of the, I suppose, the shifting age profile in the team. But, you know, Miller touched on it there. You know, Stokes with his bowlers, likes bowling him at the peak times that he thinks for them they can take wickets. And Jimmy hasn't really been like that in England or most other places, as KK was alluding to, in terms of spells, you know, at the start and middle and end of the day and nothing really much in between. But I do think, yeah, I just think he obviously is still good enough. But I think because of the way last summer panned out, I think he would want a full summer here of, you know, just feeling like Jimmy Anderson again. And also just being able to go out on his terms. And I think it's fine that he can do that. Well, it feels like it's, you know, right for him to do that now, because as we've seen from the last couple of months, the skills are still there, the energy is still there, the fitness is immaculate. And bear in mind as well, you know, he's only on a one-year deal. So there's no guarantee. Well, I mean, you know, I think it's probably likely that he may get another one, but it's not like England have overpromised to him. And so I wonder if it's something that he is considering. Bear in mind that, you know, Stuart Broad, the way he retired last year, he said that he hadn't really thought about it until the night before. We know that's books, yeah? We know he was thinking about it in 2022. And we know he was thinking about it at the start of the summer. And it just happened to work out perfectly for him. I think if Jimmy's looking at this, you know, obviously they'll never admit it, but I think maybe if he's looking at this summer, this feels like the right time to go. Because do England need him on Australia? I don't think so. I don't think he makes that much of a difference in terms of England winning the Ashes, which I appreciate sounds like heresy, but what, he'd be 43 then? He'd probably still go. He'd probably be there as a bowling coach in some capacity, but it feels like the right kind of time, not least because probably for the first time under Ben Stokes's tenure, he'll be able to call upon what he sees as his ideal attack, if that makes sense. You know, there was talk about Matthew Potts after the Dharamshala game in terms of getting him games this summer. Gus Atkinson is someone that they are impressed with, even though they didn't really look at him at all this tour. And then with Stokes bowling, you kind of feel like you've got, you know, a bit of that swing in reverse. So, yeah, I think this could be the last summer for Jimmy. And also just a word to the producer, please don't clip this up because I'm probably going to be made to look like an idiot because he's been doing that for 15 years now.
We'll save it for the eve of the 25-26 Ashes tour departing. I think Anson actually has a better record in India than he does in Australia, so that probably tells you something. Another one for Stokes to manage, obviously, Broad departing last summer. And talking of potential departures, without wishing to poop the party for one of the men to reach 100 test caps in this final test, Miller, Johnny Bairstow had a sort of very Johnny Bairstow test, a couple of fast and furious innings, a bit of sledging, obviously a lot of pride. I'm not sure he did cry, actually. He promised there'd be tears, but actually Joe Root certainly made him well up in the cap presentation, didn't he? But it feels like we're going to be back to that. How do we fit him and folks and or another wicketkeeper in the team come the summer?
Yeah, I've got so much admiration for Bairstow, not least the way that he's come back from that horrific injury. But it's incredibly hard to make a case for him continuing this summer, in all honesty. Not least, he just does not look as though he's recovered from that injury fully. There was a moment where he was sprinting towards the boundary, chasing a ball, and it was extraordinary. Just, you know, you can see it in a little bit when he's running singles, but the extent to which he was hobbling, just limping, or almost a peg leg trying to chase that ball. You cannot fault the guts, the determination, the sheer tenacity that's got him back into the England team. But he's just not the fit Bairstow that he was before the injury. So that's one element. The other element is the element that I think Vish has touched on in his excellent wrap-up piece, is that England have got to evolve. England cannot evolve from this position and not change up that middle order, because all three of that middle order went missing, Root included, at the key moments of the series. And Root and Stokes clearly are still the locks of this team, the absolute the two guys to whom everyone else looks. And therefore, someone's got to give. And it's got to be Bairstow, in my opinion, because apart from the else, Harry Brook is waiting. He will need a place back. He only got his place in the first place because Bairstow had his injury. So, you know, you can't expect him to sit on the sidelines and wait for another opportunity. If this is not the opportunity, what is? It feels like the obvious place to change things. Elsewhere, obviously, there'll be a change with one of the two spinners will doubtless give way in English conditions, which gives an opportunity for another seamer. You know, Matthew Potts has been mentioned. Josh Tung, another guy who could have been thought about on this tour but wasn't. Probably rightly, because, you know, India's a tough place to go and not have the experience of competing out there, which is another reason why I think having Anderson was probably on balance the right thing, but, you know, hindsight suggests that it didn't quite work out. But yeah, England can't just carry on the way that they've gone and expect to get back to the winning ways. You know, they have done this before, very subtly. I suppose the only person who's ever fully been dropped was, what's his face? I forgot his name already, so that goes to show.
Alex Lees.
Exactly that, Alex Lees. He's probably the only batsman so far who has been pushed out of the team on lack of merit, so to speak. But it feels as though, you know, you've got to find a way to change it up and make the team hungry again, I suppose. I mean, there was probably a lack of hunger by the end of that tour because, you know, they were looking pretty down in the dumps, I think, once the spark had gone out of the series and it was clear that they were being bested on a regular occasion by a better team.
Indeed, it was certainly a more celebratory affair, KK, for R. Ashwin, who 100th test, he picked up 9 wickets, I think, in the match. And the way he talked afterwards, kind of how he'd gone through the series, he'd got his mojo back, really, talking about kind of the variations and the kind of differing approaches he'd had to employ as the game, or as the series went along. he might never catch James Anderson, but he's got a good chance of reaching Anil Kumble, you'd think, for test wickets if he keeps going for another sort of 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I think India will continue to play these three spinners in India for as long as they can go on, I guess. And that gives Ashwin every chance of getting past Kumble. And I think the 9-for in Dharamshala was like one of the easiest 9-fors he's taken. And I say that like he bowled really well, don't get me wrong. But he bowled, I didn't think he bowled badly at all in the first two tests, but didn't get the wickets to show for first three tests, but didn't get the wickets. And sometimes that happens. He's bowled a lot of great spells without like taking wickets. So, I mean, great for him that like he, you know, marked his 100th test with 9 wickets like that and could have taken 10 for if he'd just gotten another spell as well. The question is, when India go away, I mean, it's already the case that he usually doesn't play and it's Jadeja and 4 seamers. Although in Australia, the pitches do allow India to play 3 seamers and 2 spinners. So it'll be interesting to see how they go later this year when they go there. And if conditions are typically Australian, you expect Jadeja to play and you expect another spinner to play. And the way Kuldeep is bowling, and given that he's a wrist spinner and like the way he bowled on day one in Dharamshala especially, that's the kind of thing that you could see him doing in Australian conditions. So India will be quite tempted to play him, although Ashwin on the last 2 tours of Australia has bowled beautifully as well. So it's a tough decision they'll have to take later this year.
Just on Kuldeep, I know I mentioned him previously, but I'm absolutely fascinated by the extent to which his game has developed. I remember vividly, was it 2018, the ODI?
Lords, yeah.
Lord, well, it was both the ODI yeah. series and the T20 series. He got 7-for and 6-for or something. He basically ripped through England twice because he was a left-arm wrist spinner bowling weird angles that baffled them. But then immediately England twigged that he's not very quick. We can just watch him off the pitch and smash him. And then he got taken down and was basically taken down ever since. And now suddenly he's still got that absolute bafflement that comes from being a left-arm wrist spinner producing weird angles, but now he's twice as quick. And so, you know, the combination of a guy who is quirky and different and just too quick to play off the pitch, and you have to make your decisions before you got a chance to work out what they're coming at you. I mean, that combination has been absolutely lethal for England in this series, and it's an amazing transformation that you know. I remember that it's been the traditional plight for English wrist spinners. They're always decried as being too slow. And I remember Shane Warne saying, "It doesn't matter how slow you are, just as long as what you do." I think Kuldeep has proven in the last couple of years with the way in which he's just added some extra kph to his action that actually does matter. And you know, he's got it down there at a rate of knots that has tied England in knots, frankly.
Just to jump in, like, not only is he quicker, but like, he's so confident in his action and his control and his command of length now that he's able to play around with his action if he needs to. Like in Ranchi, he decided that this is like a really slow pitch and he was running in quicker to like get a little more zip off the pitch. So that's the kind of space he's in physically and mentally as well. So, you know, he's at his peak or approaching his peak, and that's quite exciting.
Especially for tour of Australia.
Yeah.
Right, just time for a quick throw forward. But before we do that, a reminder to seek out our women's cricket podcast, ESPN Cricket Info Power Play, ahead of England's tour of New Zealand, which kicks off next week. And don't mention the clash with the WPL. Valkyrie and Furlows will make sure you're covered on both fronts. Right, looking ahead to the summer, the English summer, there's a gap of almost 4 months until England take on West Indies. Vish, I mean, you've written about this, the evolution, Baz Ball 2.0, McCullum sort of touched upon it a little bit in his post-series comments. You, I think, asked Ben Stokes about ruthlessness, or he was asked about, you know, whether they need to be more ruthless. He said he didn't like that word, but he seemed to have settled upon one by the end of Dharamshala, which was relentless. Being more relentless, what do you think England are going to be looking to think with before those series?
I don't know if there's much tinkering to be done on the whole. I think players will go away and, you know, I suppose consider what has been quite a damaging 9 months for, I suppose, for what they've been a part of, because, you know, they've enjoyed it. They've, you know, quite a few of them have emerged as better players for it, but they have nothing to show for it. Now, obviously, it's not just India. It's, we're talking about the Ashes as well and the way they flunked those first two tests. I think broadly, and I wrote this yesterday, what is clear is that there is a younger core of this England team than the traditional names of Root, Stokes, you know, Bairstow for now, that kind of main batting group, which has been synonymous with English cricket for, what, since 2012. And through what McCullum and Stokes have been able to do, both with their kind of encouragement and environment, is they've got three players now who have come to the fore in their own ways in terms of Zach Crawley and Ben Duckett. Ollie Pope to a lesser extent, but bear in mind he was vice-captain from the get-go. Well, certainly he was the first vice-captain that Stokes named. And there is a sense that having grown in the first 2 years, they now need to take this forward, because Root is clearly in his own headspace at the moment in terms of what he wants from the rest of his career. Stokes seems to be, you know, he's craving bowling again because it brings that little bit more out of him. And captaincy, I think, does wear on him, I think. And I suppose how could it not, when you're tweaking fields every ball and constantly thinking about this, you know, here and there. And, you know, it's not so much as a surprise that he's batting quite tentatively, because we saw it happen with Joe Root, we saw it happen with Alistair Cook, who, you know, and Stokes will be the first to admit this, are superior batters to Stokes. So, of course, it's going to affect him in some way. So you kind of need the other players around him to pick up the slack, and that'll be the younger players. There will obviously be personnel changes. I think he's looking a bit at the bowling. You know, I mentioned Potts and Atkinson before. I also think, you know, the wicket-keeping thing is just, it's kind of gone too far, and it's not really gone too far with just Folkes and Bairstow, but Butler before. You know, I appreciate we might be in a situation in a few years' time where we're having the same kind of conversations as we did for those three with Ollie Robinson, Jamie Smith, James Rue, maybe even Phil Salt, maybe even Ollie Pope, you know, if they decide to shift him back from three and give him the gloves. But it does feel like it's time to just move on now. I think in practice, or rather in theory, the horses for courses keeper thing works perfectly. And in practice, it just doesn't at all. And I think Folkes' batting was a good sign of that. And the fact that, you know, Bairstow is a keeper, we know what that brings out of him anyway. So there are interesting things going on. I think what was particularly, you know, McCullum almost signed off on this note, but he said he's going to go away and start plotting, as he put it. And then he's going to talk to Stokes, and they're going to come up with essentially a blueprint for the next 2 years, which essentially is what they did at the start of 2022 when they talked about when Stokes relayed the issues that England had had over the, you know, previous 2 years, and McCullum had the idea of, like, you know what, this is how we solve that. This is going to be harder. Of course it is. But they both seem quite, you know, quite driven and focused on doing so. Not least because McCullum's contract ends in 2 years' time, which is another 23 games. Stokes has the Australia Ashes in mind as a shot of redemption because, you know, he missed the 17-18 tour for the reasons that, you know, we all know, because of that evening in Bristol. He then came back undercooked after taking that mental health break in 2021, and England lost that 4-0. So there is kind of unfinished business for him. I think there's also unfinished business for McCullum, just because of the way the conversation's changed over the last 9 months. But yeah, I feel like, you know, people might say it's an underwhelming summer with West Indies and Sri Lanka. You certainly wouldn't want to underestimate West Indies, particularly after that win in Australia. But England have a lot to gain from this summer, and yeah, it's this is where McCullum earns his corn, I suppose.
Indeed. Yeah, Miller, we're sort of halfway there on Baz-Paul's road to Australia. I mean, certainly one good thing to come out of this tour is that they've got a three-way fight for to be the number one spinner.
I suppose so. I mean, yeah, I suppose that is something. I mean, Hartley has impressed particularly with the bat, and you know, you often end up saying this about spinners, certainly English spinners, is like, well, they'll keep the place because they can bat. But you know, he was, you know, I think there was some sledging coming from the India fielders saying, here comes their best batsman, when Hartley wandered in the Dharamshala. And not wrong, to be honest. I mean, he was certainly one of the most consistent. I think he struck a six in pretty much every innings and didn't strike any more than 1 6, but at least he nailed a few blows, including England's first six of the tour. But his bowling, you know, he grew into his role with huge cojones in that first test, and then went on to take 22 wickets, wasn't it? Which is quite impressive. Shoaib Bashir, I mean, you know, I don't think I would pick him as the first choice. He's probably number three for me at the moment, behind Jack Leach, who, you know, still has some credit in the bank, but I think he's probably on borrowed time, to be perfectly honest, given that Hartley just seems to have landed quite heavily with bat, ball, and you know, that height that he offers as a left-arm spinner, which is, again, credit to England's selectors for thinking outside the box and realising that that was the defining characteristic that they wanted for this tour. You know, the fact that both him and Bashir were plucked from nowhere as well just goes to underline the extent to which England have attempted to bypass the structural issues that have undermined their previous campaigns in Australia and India. You know, the positive mindset has been entirely an attempt to just shore up the dressing room that exists. It's like, you know what, lads, you're the best players in England. Play as if you're the best players in the world and see what happens. And that's, broadly speaking, worked well. And that mentality has been imbued in these new young players who've come in. So it's, you know, it's not all doom and gloom as far as I'm concerned. There's enough has come out of this tour from an England perspective to think that, you know, there's been a baton passing to a degree. You know, as I said previously, I worried that the Baz-Paul ethos would die with the senior players who introduced it. But you think of the way that that Duckett and Crawley and Bashir and Hartley and all these guys do seem to have taken on board and run with it, and would imagine keep running with it. Will certainly remember the good times. I'm sure they're encouraged to store away the moments that have worked and take it from there. So yeah, it is something. But broadly speaking, I mean, it is a symptom, I suppose, of the positive approach in England taking this tour, that we are able to pull out quite so many positives from what ended up as a bit of a car crash.
And on that note, a final word to the victors. KK, India, surely on the march now to a World Test Championship final in a bit over a year's time, I suppose, and a chance to underline their status as the great Test team of our time?
Yeah, but they're going to, you know, like, play that final if they get there. There's still work to be done, but if they get there, they're going to play that final again in England, and yeah, that always ends up evening the field to quite a degree. Yeah, but I mean, if they get there, it's another chance. Like, they've been the best Test team in the world over these three cycles, like, without doubt, to get to two finals and look like getting to another final imminently says all you need to know about, like, how good they are. And yeah, providing, say, like, all the key players remain fit and available, I mean, they have every chance of actually getting that one big crown that's eluded them so far.
Well, I won't mention anything about ICC finals and win-loss ratios and that sort of thing. We will move on politely and wrap things up, I think, as that's just about enough from us for one tour. Baz and Ben's excellent adventure continues in the summer, and they've vowed to party on all the way to the Ashes in Australia. We'll be there for every air guitar solo along the way, For now, my thanks to Alertfish and KK, and to you all for tuning in to the Switch It podcast on espncrickinfo.com.